2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 355, The Making of the Nauvoo Sunstones, a paper presented by Benson Ritter, with a response by Alan Roberts.
And he'll tell you more about that. He'll be responded to by Alan Roberts, who is an award-winning architect with Cooper Roberts Architects and co-principal, co-owner. He specializes in historic restoration. He's the co-founder of Sunstone and co-author of Salamander, The Story of the Mormon Forgery Murders, and a co-editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. Alan does a great deal of work with architectural history and historic preservation of buildings. He's also received numerous awards for his work as a preservation architect, and he's published numerous articles as well. I have to say that I've had the opportunity, the rare privilege and opportunity to work with both Benson Whittle and Alan Roberts on a variety of projects over the last 15 or 16 years that I've known them both, and they're both utterly remarkable men, Renaissance men, and in fact I would go so far as to say that they are both Renaissance masters, extremely gifted visionary men, and I would drop anything I am doing at any time to assist and work with either of these men. So I think you're going to enjoy this session.
Thank you, Maxine. Thank you, everybody, for coming. A few quick preparatory remarks. I'm going to try to make a case for cultural continuity here, as well as for the ingenuity of the creation of sunstones in Nauvoo. We're going to look at about three dozen images. Some of which have no direct bearing on Nauvoo, nor on sunstones. But I think it will become clear eventually that they're all important in the consideration of the subject. Obviously, this has to be quick, but I hope it won't be too superficial. I'd like to look at some of the ways in which sunstones fit in to the broader Western tradition. And I hope we won't have too many problems with the terminology, but if you hear a term used that you think might be indispensable to your understanding of what I'm saying and you don't recognize it, just raise a hand and I'll try to cover it briefly. I think the sunstones touch on matters spiritual, my understanding of which is somewhat limited. I usually prefer to leave such things to those who have been touched more deeply by the spirit of religious enlightenment, but I feel I can't avoid addressing them to some extent in this talk because of the nature of the subject matter. And I'd like to remark that the sunstones and the temple at Nauvoo as a whole strike me as being a very communal achievement, which of course if for that reason only matters a lot to us today, as especially those of us who are descended from people who are actually involved. What do I do to start the imagery, William? Thank you very much. This is one kind of iconographic program. It's the 12th century or late 11th, I can't remember for sure. It's Moissac, an abbey church, a great portal, Grand Portail, as they call them. It's these were intended as a kind of recipe. They vary a great deal from one place to another. Here you have the Christ in majesty, surrounded by symbols for the four evangelists and a lot of other worshipful figures, holy men, patriarchs, apostles, elders, and whatnot. Could we move on, please? Here's a second one. This is at the same period, roughly, at Autun. Very well known. One of the cases where we know the name of the designer and principal sculptor, that was Gilles Libertus. A very different kind of program or recipe. This actually depicts Christ in majesty presiding over the final judgment. I'd like to introduce a term now that might not be familiar to everybody. This is regarded by at least one scholar whom I agree with as having an anagogic purpose. Okay. Anagogic means having to do with spiritual elevation. So the idea of this particular scholar is that when one looked at this, it was supposed to heighten one's spirit by appeal to the senses. So you can look at it as a kind of mechanical thing, but it culminates in the soul, or the inner man, or the inner woman, and I like that idea because they were obviously addressing something. They were addressing the senses, and the purpose of religion and religious art is, of course, to be conducive to spiritual operations and enlightenment and so forth. And I'm going to argue that some of this goes into the making of the sunstones. When you obviously the parallels between what we're looking at here and what we'll be looking at when we come to the case of Nauvoo are somewhat limited, but there are certain similarities. One of which is that there's a high level of abstraction in symbolic art generally in both the Romanesque period, of which this is typical, and in the Nauvoo temple. And now I'd like to look at some of the individual subjects, if we could move on, please. This is from that last image, from that last tympanum, the weighing of the souls. We haven't got time to dwell on symbolism as a general subject, but maybe we'll do to remark on briefly. I think there's a bit of this missing, the balance. The weighing of the souls obviously is not a literal thing. This is, I think, what you might call an allegorical treatment. It's still symbolic in the strictest sense, which is the general thrust and purpose of most work in the Romanesque period. That's another parallel with Nauvoo. The sunstones have been called allegorical, and they've been referred to as symbols. I deal with this to some extent in the paper published by Sunstone. Next frame, please. Now here's another piece from Autun, presumably by the same workshop, the famous Eve figure. Another case of where you have a potential for narrative art, which of course is one of the main kinds of religious art distinguishable from symbolic art, but it's a case where the figure acts in a symbolic way, even though it's involved in a biblical narrative. Part of the success of this figure, of course, has to do with the level of abstraction employed in the rendering of the figure, which stylistically is not really entirely distinguishable from the other elements of the composition. Could we see Jeremiah now, please? This is also from Wasak, which is where the first tympanum we looked at is located. This is Jeremiah. Obviously not a portrait. Nobody knows what Jeremiah looked like. Not a naturalistic rendering. And yet somehow it seems to have a kind of discernible spiritual content. The next frame, I fear, is upside down. But it's, it's the sacrifice of Isaac. William worked very hard to do a 180 with that yesterday, but it just couldn't happen. Everybody back on your heads. could we move on, please? This is from another Abbey church in Aulnay, France, and I picked it because it indicates how diverse this symbology could be back in that time, and it obviously in an era in which they'd had hundreds and hundreds of years to work on it. I won't go into what they're all meant to represent, but suffice to say they in that era were drawing on lots of different sources, just as Joseph Smith and William Weeks were doing in Nauvoo. They had more time, and so their outsourcing of imagery was more varied. Here you have elders and apostles, but you also have representations on the outer archivolt, the topmost one, of virtues and vices and composites, which is to say creatures which consist of elements drawn from more than one creature, and obviously of an imaginary character, which had, we assume, important symbolological content for at least some of the people who made and looked at them. Now the next one is from one of the stave churches in Norway, and I picked this one because I think it's so so strange, and yet I think it's safe to assume that it meant something to people who thought of themselves as Christians. And even though a lot of the imagery was drawn from pagan sources, as is often the case, and you could argue, and it would be true, that the sunstones of Nauvoo are drawn partly from pagan sources. And it's not necessarily the case that they didn't pass through Christian sources before they reached Nauvoo, but ultimately, like much Christian art before it, it comes from a background that doesn't necessarily have a lot to do with what the purposes for which the imagery is being used in the new application. Could we move to the map, please? Does anyone recognize this image? This is known as the Surrealist Map of the World. It was published in a publication called Variété in 1929. Has anyone zeroed in on North America? So quite a lot of it's missing, and some of it's extra big. This possibly says more about... Have we lost that? that image possibly says more about the surrealists than it does about the United States, but the fact that the United States was so deliberately excised from that map, I think requires that we wonder why. And it's partly because the surrealists in some sense were concerned with spirituality, with imagination in art. They were very concerned about the value of being very actively connected to the vital life forces of the earth. They were generally urban people who had been cut off from that, so they were trying to find ways back into it. And they liked native art. They liked oceanic art. The reason why Alaska is so big there is that it's the mask work of the Alaskan Indians. But that still doesn't explain why the United States is missing. Why would the United States be missing? I think it's partly because of Protestantism. I think it's largely to do with the idea that the Anglo-Protestant world had not at that point contributed a great deal in the field of visual art. And if you think about it, there's probably more truth than we'd like to be comfortable with in this. I would like to ascribe it broadly to the iconoclasm of the Protestant Reformation, the Radical Reformation, and the idea and the fact really that an awful lot of human culture, including art, religious art, was blotted out by our ancestors. And so I think one of the reasons why I was fascinated by the work at Nauvoo, that's a Lamanite painting from Lamanite ritual dancers from Bonampak, Mexico, painted in the 10th century. You're supposed to laugh. This actually comes at the end. Can we? This is that's the very final one, which we're not quite ready for. So there we go. I'll keep talking while we flip through these and try to find our way to the Allen and Lane stones from New England. So just quickly, we don't really have time to cover all of this. I'd like to move to a couple of these New England gravestones which appeared in the Sunstone article. They are representations of what Alan I. Ludwig, author of this book, calls sun soul effigies. He believes these are depictions or representations, symbolic representations of the soul in flight from death towards glorification. One of the important discoveries of his work on New England gravestones is that there evolved in the late 17th and 18th centuries a tradition of depicting the soul in flight by various means, including birds, doorways, and winged heads, previously in use by other cultures. Into what he calls soul effigies in general, of which these are a variant. I believe that it's possible that these are conscious or unconscious background material or source material for the Nauvoo Sunstone. Alan is going to cover the argument for the Masonic sources, which is far better qualified to do than I am, so I'm largely going to bypass that. This is, since it didn't make it onto the PowerPoint program, one of the leading representations of what this author refers to as soul effigies. They're very abstract. Sometimes they're winged. Often they're very weird in appearance. They sometimes look Celtic. They often look prehistoric. And he refers to them all as primitive. Obviously they're more primitive than the face in the Sun in Splendor, which became part of the Nauvoo Sunstones. But I will argue that there's a certain strangeness in the Nauvoo depictions, which possibly hark back to that earlier tradition. Could we move on now, please? This is the Chad Brownstone from Providence, Rhode Island. It caught my eye very early in the consideration of New England sunstones, gravestones in connection with sunstone imagery in Nauvoo, because it reveals something very close to those portions of the head which are exposed above the acanthus leaves in the early drawings for the Nauvoo Order by William Weeks. The next frame is one of the more interesting gravestones from New England. It's very complex. In a nutshell, it's death with a couple of threshold figures represented by the sun and the moon, encircled by the universal symbol of eternity, the self-pursuing serpent or Ouroboros. And the reason I wanted to focus on this a little bit is that one of the main things happening here is you're getting an allegorical treatment through a fairly complex remixing of traditional imagery, and that is exactly what is happening in Nauvoo. A quick look at some Masonic imagery published in a 19th century book that would have been available to the early brethren. The Sun in Splendor at 12 o'clock above the arch. I hope that Alan will acquaint us better with this entire topic. Could we move on to the Casa del Sol in Cáceres? This is in Extremadura, Spain. It's a late 16th century or early 17th century palacete, belonging to a family for whom I believe this was the coat of arms. And it may as well be here that we mention that the source for all Suns in Splendor in the Western tradition appears to be heraldic. That is to say, it had to do with the evolution of medieval heraldry, which it was originally a means of identification of individuals, and later became extended to whole families and clans. This would represent the Solis family of that part of Spain at that time. These palacetes, or small mansions, which they're not, they're actually fairly large, but I suppose small in comparison with the king's palace, were built by conquistadores and others who had done well in the New World. The next frame is, you could question the relevancy of this. Some think it's a solar image, straight or conventional. Mainstream art historians call it a Gorgoneon or Gorgonian. Others, fringe people, regarded as more of a solar-based local deity, god type of thing with knowledge implications. It's also a complexly rendered subject with representing a particular vision, as does the sunstone in Nauvoo. This is from a first century temple in Western England, preserved in the museum at the Baths complex in Bath Avon. We're going to have to hurry. I can see. How much time do we have? Much time? Yes, roughly. I get about 10 more minutes? Okay, we better dash along then. The schematic, a drawing, a line drawing of the Corinthian capital by Palladio, Andrea Palladio. Apparently, it's a classical invention. Probably, it's been attributed to Polycletus, the renowned sculptor whose works were regarded as canonical, both in classical times and in the Middle Ages. In the next frame, we see the leading building, which is considered to have been a source for the Nauvoo Temple by James Gibbs, designed early in the 18th century. It was published and diffused widely in the English-speaking world in the form of engravings. Views of this church, the elevations of this church, that is, along with other works by James Gibbs. An art historian, an architectural historian in England told me that it's as likely William Weeks would have possessed a copy of the book containing these engravings as that he would have owned a framing square. And indeed, Laurel B. B. Andrew, a historian of 19th century Mormon architecture, cites this as a leading source. The next image shows how those Corinthian columns, Corinthian capitals, were used by Gibbs in that building. We'll go from here to a series of inhabited capitals, which is also what the sunstone is. The sunstone became what we call an inhabited capital. As I stated in the article, the inhabited capitals were invented by the Romans, and they flourished and had their heyday in the High Middle Ages. These are 13th century Spanish capitals. These are headed capitals, also inhabited capitals, technically. The Nauvoo, the sunstone, is a headed inhabited capital. This is a figured or historiated inhabited capital. This is a Bible story from the Old Testament. Balaam and his ass, and the angels around the corner, trying to get his attention. Birds, possibly ibis, birds from a capital in northeastern Spain, in the Catalan region, where Romanesque art was very strong. The next one is from a Sasanian source, originally an Armenian design, probably brought into Spain or southern France by the Sasanians when they were giving the Eastern Empire fits in the 7th century. I think there's another one. Oh yes, this is a headed inhabited capital, chosen obviously largely for its symbolic meaning in a Norwegian stave church, as it's not doing anything structural, nor even appearing to do anything structural, neither in an arcuated nor in a trabeated way, so it's totally irrelevant except as a symbol, and yet it's trying to look like a capital. I guess we'll just have to have a quick look at that and move on. That's the Maestro of Cabestani, a sculptor of renown whose name we don't know, who worked in the Rhone River Delta. The next one will be a strong Mozarabic design imported from Persia and into southern Spain by the Moors, and carved at Silos in northern Spain in the late 11th century. Now we come to the Nauvoo order. There's that portion of the face peeping over the acanthus leaves. These drawings are not dated, so it's very hard to know for sure in what order this thing all happened and how it evolved. I suggest I was going to read my ideas for how this came to be from the article, just to try to pull all of this together. Does anyone think that that's necessary? Are things going all right as they are? Okay, let's talk about this for a minute. I think it's clear from this drawing that William Weeks had grander aspirations for the Nauvoo Temple than actually materialized. The it's clear that he hoped to use columns. They might have been engaged columns, but he was hoping to use columns. He ended up with pilasters or pilasters. The columns were to be fluted. His original idea was to retain the acanthus leaves, which would have meant that the sunstones would have become something more like a traditional Renaissance or medieval inhabited capital than what actually happened. Obviously, the horns came in to play, the trumpets, that is, at a later time. And if we move on, we can possibly trace that evolution a little bit. I'd like to call attention to the rays. A straight ray treatment with alternating large and small ones is definitely Masonic. That is to say, if you're looking for a source close to the Nauvoo Temple, that is one area where I think it is clearly of that derivation. The next image gives us some that brings us a lot closer to what we ended up with. The trumpets have been introduced, possibly suggesting to a New England gravestone influence. You still have acanthus leaves out of which the face is emerging, and those later were converted to stylized water for reasons that we can only speculate about. And one of the ideas that I have to offer is, which didn't occur to me until a couple of days ago, is that if the Nauvoo sunstones are taken at the eschatological level, having to do with final things, the glorification of the soul, the migration of the soul from death into glory, the water motif could even be the waters of Jordan. But I've suggested so many possible interpretations in the parts that got published in the magazine that I think it's pretty clear that there's plenty of ambivalence and ambiguity, and plenty of people are going to derive plenty of different interpretations from the experience of looking at the sunstones. From here we go to war-torn Nauvoo, as William called it yesterday. This is after the fire and after the tornado, but it's about the best image we have of the sunstones. It's pretty clear that they were trying to do something similar with the stylized water. It really doesn't differ a lot from the acanthus leaf treatment. It is something else, but formalistically, as abstraction, it's acting in a very similar way. I do believe that the strangeness of the face, which could be attributed to a vision on the part of the Prophet Joseph, also suggests a connection to the primitive gravestone work. Could we move on, please? And by the way, that last image is probably the best we're going to get in getting any feel for what kind of anagogic influence those capitals might have exercised on the viewer without going to Nauvoo and taking our chances on the reproduction work that has now been installed in the new temple. This is, you know, another vestige of war-torn Nauvoo. These are pictures of the same image, the same sunstone, one of the better preserved, but none of them has a perfectly intact nose, and so I'm afraid there's really not a canonical source for sunstones, for the way they were restored, for the way I restored the one that I worked on, or the way the church handled the 30 reproductions, which are now in the temple. Have I got a couple more minutes?
Probably about 1 minute.
All right. Well, I'll try to make it quick then. Let's just look at that's the one I worked on, close-up of it. Let's move on quickly, please, William, to the move on to the crucifixes. And sorry, oh, this is the Smithsonian sunstone. It's the Smithsonian sunstone in that picture, which unfortunately is much published was taken from an awkward angle. Nobody's managed to get up on a scaffold even with the thing. I was on a scaffold there, but without a camera, for 3.5 days taking measurements. And I can tell you that it does look a lot like that, but it is distorted. This is actually a semicircle rather than parabolic, as it appears to be there. And I think one of the reasons that I think this possibly makes it look even weirder than it did look. But maybe it was intended to look that way because it was never meant to be viewed from a position horizontal to it or level with it. So now, very quickly, and this will interest Maxine, I believe, quite a lot because she's been looking at the duality, the idea of the sunstone and moonstone as a dyad. This is a wall painting in a chapel at the old cathedral in Salamanca. It's later than the cathedral. I think it's 14th century when this painting was done. Sun and moon, Christ, seated Christ in a mandorla with sun and moon. Joseph Campbell refers to these as when sun and moon are used in this context as threshold images, mystical connections between the seen and the unseen cosmos. There's one more of these. It's the next image. This is from the cathedral at Orvieto, and it is carved out of marble. And I present these because they're just another slant or another wrinkle on what has been done with that kind of cosmological imagery in past times. And now to sum up very quickly, I picked something out of my notes, which says, thus, through an ingenious mixing of available source material, was created a capital which embodied the prime feature of Latter-day Saint eschatology, intelligence, or the glory of the sun, which at the same time stated the role of the newly revealed gospel in relation to the established creeds, and which, though perhaps not with this specific intent, and you have to know a lot about Nauvoo probably to appreciate this and to see that it might not be as extravagant as it sounds, put the image of a solar deity and or his transfigured supplicants in a massive-headed capital 30 times. And with that, I'll turn things over to Alan. Thank you.
I don't have any pictures, I'm sorry. You just have to use your imagination. I am responding to Ben's longer paper, a condensed and edited version of which appears in the current issue of Sunstone. I had not seen all of these images, but I think that my comments address very specifically his basic thesis and support points. A week ago, I attended the monthly meeting of a study group founded 9 years ago by Scott Kenney, and we spoke at the end of what we might talk about in the upcoming months. Scott is one of three authors writing a new 3-volume history of Joseph Smith, and he asked the group if we might like to discuss the topic of lies and deception, especially as it might apply to the life and religious career of Joseph Smith. And I said, the big question for everyone connected to Mormonism is, who was Joseph Smith? What really drove and motivated him? And what was he thinking when he did all that he did in his 39 action-packed years? As I have said in other places at other times, his statement, "No man knows my history," may be the truest thing he ever said. We all understand a part of him, but no one knows all of him. Ben Whittle is trying to reveal a little more. In attempting to determine the religious meaning behind the architectural symbols of the Nauvoo Temple, Ben has done a credible job of examining both period and later written sources, as well as possible physical precursors from Joseph Smith's early Eastern U.S. environment. Smith and other key designers and builders of the temple had traveled fairly widely, and it is at least possible that they could have been influenced by some of the symbology in gravestone art and churches and other images that Ben showed on the screen, as well as by architects and builders' design books which were circulating at the period. Smith read widely and collected a variety of books. Brigham Young, leader under whose influence the temple was pushed to completion and dedicated nearly 2 years after Smith's death, likewise collected and used builders' guides, carpenters' guides. Although by the time he took over the project, the key design decisions, including the use of iconographic symbols, had already been made. Young, however, would later follow Smith's lead and employ the same sun, moon, and star symbols, along with others, in the Salt Lake Temple. More about this later. Without additional information, we cannot be sure what meaning Smith intended to convey through the Nauvoo symbols. Ben has given us his best educated, informed guess by providing several plausible options in the absence of a definitive statement from the mouth of Joseph Smith or his cohort designers and builders. The explanation by early Mormon Wandell Mace, and Ben quotes this very interesting statement from his autobiography, relates the Nauvoo order of architecture to, quote, a representation of the church, the bride, and the Lamb's wife mentioned in Revelation 12. As Ben points out, this interpretation is ingenious but uncorroborated by other sources. And the other early Mormon accounts are few and unspecific. Later writers on the temple, such as James Talmage in his 1968 House of the Lord, Lundwall in his 1971 Temples of the Most High, and even architectural historian Mark Hamilton's 1995 book, 19th Century Mormon Architecture and City Planning, go to great lengths to describe the Nauvoo Temple in detail, but basically fail to mention or describe the solar system symbols, let alone offer an interpretation as to their meaning. Why would they all make such a glaring omission? One clue: they all were or are faithful members of the church. More on that later, too. Also an active member, but an exception to the rule, was E. Cecil McGavin, whose 1946 book, Nauvoo the Beautiful, is extensively quoted in Ben's paper. It is McGavin who assembled the best collection of descriptions of the temple, its appearance, its symbolism, whether the accounts be Mormon or Gentile, friendly or unkind. I will not repeat these. They're all through Ben's paper. But observe that the early viewers of the sunstones were confused, bemused, bewildered, and occasionally inspired. But even McGavin could not provide sources which gave clear, definitive meanings to the symbols. He did, however, try to solve this dilemma in a one-year later book, his 1947 Mormonism and Masonry. In the latter, he acknowledges that both the Mormons and Masons employed the same iconographic symbols, but he concludes that, quote, when the Mormons employed any or all of the common symbols, and he was referring here to the similarities between the Mormon and Masonic temple vestments, continuing the quote, they were borrowing from the Bible, not from Masonry. So he takes the apologetic position. McGavin spends the rest of the book trying to persuade us of this claim, but for reasons which I will explain momentarily, I'm not convinced. I do not know who the first Mormon was to use 1 Corinthians 15 and Doctrine and Covenant 76 to interpret the Mormon and other Nauvoo and other Mormon sun, moon, stars, stones. McGavin attempts to do this in Mormonism and Masonry. This is a effort, however, and he does nothing to show us that Joseph Smith or any other early Mormon had this connection in mind. Others, such as, and I mentioned some other people who essentially do the same thing, they quote these two scriptures and apply them retroactively 100 and some years later to those stones. I too have investigated the question of what Joseph Smith was thinking and from whence he was influenced when he verbally directed the design of the Nauvoo Temple and other Mormon symbols. I've examined this question in my 1979 Sunstone article, Where Are the All-Seeing Eyes? The Origin, Use, and Decline of Early Mormon Symbolism. Here I quote Laura Blank Andrew, who Ben also quotes, who observed, quote, Mormons had a predilection for symbolism. As millennialists, they regarded the visible world as a metaphor for religious truths, unquote. But where did the idea for the specific symbols most likely originate? We have heard the standard later Mormon view that they came from Scripture, especially the Bible and the Doctrine and Covenants. But if Mormon Scripture provided the inspiration, we would expect a significant amount of symbolism to have been derived from that all-important Scripture of the early Church, the Book of Mormon. It provided a wealth of imagery, as in the Tree of Life, the Iron Rod, the Urim and Thummim, and the Liahona. But we look in vain for graphic depictions of these potential symbols on the Nauvoo or Salt Lake or any other early Mormon temples, tabernacles, or meeting houses. They simply do not exist anywhere. We do find in these buildings symbols that could have had biblical precedent, but are clearly used liberally in Freemasonry, along with other symbols in Mormon buildings that were used exclusively in Freemasonry. Let me say that again. There are symbols on the Mormon buildings that could have biblical precedence, but there are other symbols on Mormon buildings that have only Masonic precedent. The most dramatic example, for purposes of our discussion here, would be the weather vane placed atop the Nauvoo Temple, perhaps designed at Smith's direction, drawn by William Weeks, and later installed under Brigham Young's direction. It featured a prone angel dressed in temple clothing, holding a book in one uplifted hand and blowing a trumpet with the other. The angel is held in place by a vertical pole or spear topped by what appears to be a flame of fire. Below the flame and above the angel is an interlocking compass and square, like that. Exactly like the ones found in Masonic handbooks and buildings and vestments, and identical to the one on Brigham Young's Masonic lapel pin shown in Utah photographs of the Mormon leader. By the way, the new temple, which has just been, it's not proper to say reconstructed. I think we'd have to say replicated. It was done very faithfully according to photos, archaeology, and so forth, except for the weather vane, which has a vertical Moroni with a horn similar to Salt Lake, no Masonic symbols. There was a model of the original temple in the visitor's center with the horizontal angel and the compass and square, and the day after the visitor's center opened, those elements were removed from that model as well. Who knows why? The result of my 1970s research into early Mormon symbolism was the not preconceived conclusion that every symbol used by 19th century Mormons had its origin in the graphic symbology of Freemasonry. For those of you not familiar with the connection between early Mormonism and Freemasonry, I can say that it is difficult to understate the importance of this connection. A few key examples will suffice. Joseph and Hiram Smith, 11 of the 12 apostles, as well as William Weeks, the architect, Charles Lambert, one of the stone carvers, and other Nauvoo builders were all active Masons. The first temple completed in Nauvoo was not the church's temple, but the church-built Masonic temple, a three-story edifice dedicated on April 6th, commemorating the church's founding, 1884, 2.5 months prior to Joseph Smith's death. In other words, the Masonic temple was the one that was pushed to completion before his death. The Mormon endowment is derived in significant measure from the Masonic endowment, as are the Mormon temple vestments. Mormon endowments were performed in the Masonic temple before they were performed in the church's temple, completed later. Just as it appears that church endowments were performed in San Pete County by Apostle Orson Hyde in the Spring City Endowment House before they were performed in the later completed Manti Temple. The Spring City Endowment House, which I once owned, has above the doors a large stone plaque with a carved beehive, compass, and square. very popular symbols of the Masonic order. So in looking for origins of symbols, as well as their possible meaning, I believe we should look at the source most immediately available to and very strongly influential on Joseph Smith, which would be Freemasonry. Reed Durham, former president of the Mormon History Association, wrote in 1975, quote, "I am convinced that in the study of Masonry lies a pivotal key to further understanding Joseph Smith and the Church. Masonry and the Church had its origins prior to the time Joseph Smith became a Mason. It commenced in Joseph's house when his older brother became a Mason. The many parallels found between early Mormonism and the Masonry of that day are significant. The same Masonic influences exerted a more dominant character as reflected in the further expansion of the Church subsequent to the Prophet's Masonic membership." And this is an important quote. "In fact, I believe that there are few significant developments in the Church that occurred after March 15, 1842, which did not have some Masonic influence." Unquote. He then mentioned several examples, including the creation of the Relief Society, the Council of 50, the Endowment. He says regarding the Nauvoo Temple architecture that it was, quote, "in part at least, Masonically influenced. Indeed, it appears that there was an intentional attempt to utilize Masonic symbols and motifs," unquote. Ben acknowledges the possibility of Masonic influence as being one among many, but I would say that he emphasizes it too little. Moreover, it is possible that some of the other non-Mormon sources were also Masonically influenced, it being pervasive in Eastern American culture at the time. Ben mentions the, quote, "Masonic source in the heraldic sun and splendor as a possible influence on Nauvoo sunstone, and that the moon and star images, too, are Masonic, often occurring together with the sun." He adds, quote, "they do not, however, refer to anything in particular, such as the Masonic degrees," unquote. I have a different view of that. The moon and stars had very significant theological meaning to the Masons. Stars are quoted with gods and Christ, as well as, quote, "great intellectuality" in a Freemasonry encyclopedia, whereas the moon is the secondary lesser light in Freemasonry. The moon lights the wanderer in the way by night. What about the sun? Quote, "the sun rises in the east, the place for the worshipful master," and that would be a high-ranking Masonic leader, "as the sun is a source of all life and warmth. So should the worshipful master enliven and warm the brethren in their work." 1 minute. Okay, 1 minute to read. We'll just whiz by this. Ben puzzles in his paper as to why the solar symbols are out of logical order with respect to their vertical placement in the Nauvoo Temple. The reason may be that the logic is Masonic, not scriptural or eschatological. In the 19th century, Masonic way of seeing things, the stars representing God were superior than the worshipful master, who we may equate in this instance with Joseph Smith himself. That's not exceptional. Charles II of France declared himself the Sun King, and many people actually before Joseph Smith had that same idea. Lastly, the moon, the secondary light. So in other words, in the Nauvoo Temple, you have the star on the top, which represents God, the sun, which represents the worshipful master, in this case, Joseph Smith himself, and at the bottom, the flock, the followers, the moon, the secondary light, the secondary group. Well, I was going to talk about Brigham Young and carrying symbolism to Salt Lake and the controversy that had occurred. The temple architects and general authorities arguing about the proper use of Masonic symbolism in the Salt Lake Temple and the exclusion of Saturn stones, Earth stones, compass and squares, which were drawn on the early Salt Lake Temple drawings, and how all of those were removed, and how John Taylor finally won the argument by outliving everybody and simplifying the symbology in Salt Lake City. The idea being that it wasn't just a Nauvoo thing with Joseph Smith. Brigham Young was committed to that too. So I think what I'll do is just read kind of a conclusion. So what are we to make of this early marriage of Masonry and Mormonism? There are many options, and I leave it to each of you to choose one. You may like Ben's broad-minded approach, wherein he says, quote, in view of such ambivalence in symbolic art, any, many, or all of the above suggestions and others are viable, no matter what the presiding brethren or builders thought was happening on the capitals. That is, he's saying, in effect, interpret them as you will, given the absence of declared meaning. I'm reminded of J. Golden Kimball's approach to the church. I believe what I can, and I ignore the rest. Ben also says, the first Mormon venture into architectural iconography has to be classed as success, if only because of the multiplicity of ways in which it might engage the eyes and mind of the viewer. This sounds like wisdom to me. As for my view, I think the symbols do reflect Joseph Smith's thinking and approach to creating a new religious tradition. My opinion now is not much different than it was 23 years ago when I wrote, and I cannot quote you. There's a couple of paragraphs in this 1979 issue of Sunstone that has my article in it. But basically, I talk about his being a eclectic synthesis, gathering things from his environment and kind of recasting them and giving them new meanings, investing them with new meanings. This confusion was apparent on the part of the builders in the 1840s, but perhaps we can rise above it today, as Ben has suggested, and reinvest the anachronistic symbols of the past, whatever their origins and lost meanings, with new ideas meaningful to us today, as we continue our quest to find God and truth and related meaning in our lives.